Thank you for letting me join you, and what a nice event. I was driving down, and I was following the directions on the flyer that I'd been given, and I thought, 288, you go west, then you, no, you go, was it west? Yeah, you go west, you go 0.7 miles, and as I was driving along, I came to what looked like the first turn to the left, so I whipped into that left lane, and there's no place to go. So I got back out on the big four-lane road, and I went the next... looked like a place to turn left. It had a left lane off the main drive, and I jumped over into that, and there was no place to go. And I thought, maybe I should have paid more attention to the 0.7 part of this trip. I came on down, found Liberty, took a left, went in, and went around the circle, and there I was here. It was great. Thank you for letting me be here. Jerry, thank you. I appreciate you inviting me and letting me share what life was like, what happened, and what it's like today for me now that I'm in a 12-step life and enjoying Al-Anon. I will say that, Dan, you probably are a benchmark host for me. You and Ed jumped in a car and drove up to Chattanooga to check me out on a Thursday night. He called and let me know he was coming so he could be sure I would be there. And I said, okay. And so he came on in and they participated, and it was great. And that was just before Ed had his leg cut off and glued back on. So he was pretty agile at that time. I also want to say thank you to the speakers that are here. Steve was just great last night. I am so sad that I had to follow him. It's just not fair. And I'm excited to think about Don sharing. Don's the next speaker this evening, right? No, who is?
Lee.
The Lee. I kept pondering. I said, this is going to be great. So, Lee, I'm excited because I have not heard your story. This will be great. I feel like I know Lee because I've seen him so many times, but I've just never heard his story. So that's even better. I just took the name right off the yellow sheet. Julie, you're tomorrow? I'm here. I'm staying. And finally, I don't know what this is. What is the entertainment with Jody or Jody? Jody?
Oh?
Neil Diamond. I don't know if that means dancing or not, but I'm finding out tonight. I'm going to be there. I will tell you that if it does, you're in for a very sad experience. It's not going to be a big issue. I'll just sit there and admire those. I'll stick with Ed. We'll move the same way. I'd like to just jump right into what it was like for me. I was born into a family that was composed of two entirely different sides. It was my mom's side and my dad's side. My mother was born into a family where it was, she's out of the southeast here, born in Greenville, South Carolina. And my mother, when she was raising us, taught us some rules. Now, she didn't call them rules, but she let me know that this is how we live. And in our family, we had secrets, things that we don't talk about. We may do them, and they may happen, but we don't let anybody else know about those. Secondly, we knew that no matter what you did or how you did it, with whom you did it, we stick together. Right or wrong, we stick together. And we also had this rule that if we're wrong, we will never admit it anyway. I remember hearing those very words come right out of my mother's mouth. And loyalty was just the name of the game. And it turns out we were a very small family, and we were pretty much with ourselves. My dad came from Kansas, and my dad just came from a whole different background. And he came from a place where you worked hard, and you said it like it was, and that's just the way life was, and you accepted life for what it was. I mean, he was just a matter-of-fact guy. My dad was as close to an Al-Anon influence as I could have imagined for a man that never heard of and has never been part of Al-Anon. And how he and Mom got married, I asked him one time, and he said, oh, I pulled in Greenville, South Carolina one time to get gas, and she pumped it. That's how they met. I mean, that's as romantic as it gets in our family. What I would like to mention about being raised in this family was that my mother knew only what she had been taught by her dad and her mom, and she taught us what they had taught her, and we in turn were passing it on. This was a family disease. It is generational. And if it doesn't stop with us, it just keeps being passed on. And I didn't realize all this at the time. I just thought that was the way life was with everyone and that our family was no different. So I was part of that family, and I had what I would call a relationship model. And the reason that matters is because the way they interacted and the things they did, I built relationships later in my life that was an attempt by me to recreate what was familiar because I knew how to be comfortable with that. And so I would look for people who knew how to play the game the way I had been raised playing the game, and for me, it was a game. I didn't know to call it that. I thought that's the way life worked, but I found out that was really the way my life was working, and it wasn't working very well. The other thing was, in our family, we had never been involved in a church. We had no God. God was not a word we would think about. It was not something we knew anything about. It was just, I knew there were churches, but I didn't know what they would do. There was something going on over there, and we just weren't part of it. My dad was in the military, so we moved a lot. Every couple of years, we would go from one base to the next base to the next. So I started every relationship with a goodbye, and that was just the way it kind of worked, and I didn't think anything about that either. So, you know, when you're a kid and you don't know any better, that's just the way it is. But it was an imprint on me. Somewhere along the line, when I was about 14 years old, we moved. It was a military transfer, so we moved to a place called Waco, Texas. And in Waco, this is where my life began to actually go into some really different directions. One of the things that happened to me while I was there was, and I cannot explain this. I'll share it. It's just the way it is. I was standing in the backyard. I was underneath what is called a chinaberry tree. And it's a smooth bark tree. It has no value whatsoever. It has berries that fall off every year, and they smell bad. But it was my tree, and I would crawl up in that tree, and it was just a great tree in my backyard. And one day, I was just out there, and I don't know what was going on. I just remember all of a sudden, I stood very still, and I knew, without doubt, two things. I was going to be a minister, and I knew that I would never have children. It was just crystal clear, no doubt, no ambiguity. I didn't debate it. It was a fact of life for me from that point on. I just never thought anything about it, and I didn't think about it anymore after that. It just was something that happened. The other thing is that while I was there, at 14, I discovered girls. They used to be boring, but now they're interesting. Now, it's a funny thing about me. I think I'm a broken thinker. I was raised in a family where we thought differently, but I now begin to realize I had some broken thinking. When I was up on that farm in Minnesota when I was about 8 years old, before I ever got to Waco, I was up in a haymow one day, and there was this little girl that lived right next door to us, and she was up in the haymow, and I decided the only smart thing for me to do was impress her. So I grabbed a piece of twine in that haymow, and I was going to show her how Tarzan could swing out that haymow. Tarzan used bigger ropes. I started out with a scream, and I kept the scream going all the way down. But if you ever find yourself in a haymow, and you're thinking about swinging out the door, think about it some more. They had piled up steel rims down below with the tires taken off, and I just landed in a pile of them. And every place there was a rim, there was a different angle on a bone. It was just, it seemed so stark at the time. They had broken both arms. They put casts on both arms. And the only thing I remember from it is a picture standing in the bed in the hospital in the paper saying, "Look, Ma, both arms." That was broken thinking, and I didn't recognize it. I just thought, well, strange things happen to me. Well, I was in Waco, Texas, and I discovered girls, and there was this girl who was about 16 years old, and I was 14, and she said, "If you want to date me, you're going to have to go to church with me." Sure, what's that all about? I'm glad to go. And I started going to that church, and I became more interested after I after I was there for a while, and what was being told and talked about in the church than I was in her. So it wasn't too long before that I got very involved in what I now look upon as being a religious belief that's a little bit to the far side. I often have thought of it as a cult. By the way, when I got into the 12-step life, I thought you were a cult. You had your special book. But I got to tell you, you're the worst run cult I ever saw. I mean, you can't even raise money. What's this dollar thing? You know, and what's the thing about who's in charge? You know, what's this thing about what are the rules? There aren't any. Who's right? Well, what do you think? It was just a very different kind of a group to get with. Because where I came from, this is the way it is. This is how it works. And while I was in that religious group, that pretty far right group, I learned a lot of things about God. And they were very clear to me about God. When I look back on it today, what I can tell you I learned was that there's a game going on between me and God. And if I do certain things just right and in just a certain way, I've got God in a corner. And then God has to do A, B, C, or D. Sound at all familiar? That's how they talk. And if I sacrifice, which that meant go without food, as they called it, fasting, it was even more likely that this good stuff was going to happen to me. I fasted a lot while I was in that church. And what I can tell you was, I would start a fast, and in 2 or 3 days later when we would break it, all I thought about for 3 days was getting an orange or a bowl of soup. I never got anything out of fasting except being hungry. They said, stay with it. The point that I would tell you about this is that it's very important for you to understand that I ended up learning a lot of things about a higher power based on what somebody else told me, but that I had never experienced for myself. And I hung on to those things because I believed that they were true. And that molded a lot of my thinking about a higher power. When I graduated from high school, I went on to a seminary. I went to Houston, Texas, 4 years in a seminary. And while I was there, I was on fire to do what I thought I was supposed to do. But there was something going on with me, because when I had gone through what their conversion experience was, something on the inside of me never changed. But I was living, doing, acting, all the things on the outside. And I had stumbled into an experience where my insides didn't match my outsides. And after I graduated from seminary, and I kind of worried about this a little bit, because at seminary they kept saying I was supposed to be a new creature and something different inside, and I was me, but I had a great paint job. Pinstripes, I looked good. I pastored a church for 8 years in Spartanburg, South Carolina, and by the way, I can tell you, you think I was crazy in the haymow, you should have seen me as a pastor. I was not the best catch for that church. One example is I was in bed late one night, and the phone rang, and it was raining, it was cold or something, and I was half awake, and they said, we've got somebody that needs to be baptized. And I said, oh, tonight? Man, this is late. Yeah, right now, we got to get her baptized tonight. So a member of her family brought her over. My wife, I was married at the time. We went to the church, and this woman was a substantial woman, and she had a disability. I mean, she had multiple sclerosis, fairly advanced, and she could barely function. And so I said, okay, let's do this. Now, what we had for a baptismal tank was this metal tank, and it was designed so we could put the person baptized in it, and we could have me stand outside of it. Then when you bend them over, because we would saturate you, we did not want you to get sprinkled, we wanted you under the water, then I wouldn't have to get wet. You got wet, I stayed dry. This is a great deal. We hadn't had a baptism in a good while, and the water level had been going down, and I didn't know it. So when we got her in there with a great deal of effort, I said, here's how we're going to do this. You hold this. Over we went. And I kept having to go lower and lower. And finally, I just pitched in on top of her. And she was still hanging on to my hands and would not let go. And my feet were off the floor. I was jackknifed over the wall of the baptismal tank. And my face is this far from the water. And my wife, who was 95 pounds, 4 foot 10 inches, ran and leaped on the back of my legs and sawed down real hard. And we got her about halfway up. And down she went again. And then, so 2 or 3 tries, and finally we just got her up somehow and got her where she could stand. And when she let go of my hand, she said she had never felt so close to God. She just didn't know. It was an Easter Sunday one time, and we were in an older church with wooden pews. You remember those? And the back would be kind of curved, and the seat would be kind of curved. And it was Easter. I wanted it to look good, so I didn't know any better. Grab the twine and swing out the door. So I bought a case of Pledge, and I polished those metal pews. Easter Sunday came around. You should have seen them. They were beautiful. But the people came in and they were sitting there, and I was preaching, and as I was looking out, I could see people. It was like looking at water at the beach. It was just, and I thought, what is that about? And turns out when we finally dismissed and they all stood and watched that, the backsides of their clothes, they were shiny. It was unbelievable. You should have had me for a pastor. But as a pastor, one of the things that happened was that one day I was down at a public place, and I had a job as a pastor because it was a very small church. And one of the guys that worked for me on that job, I was telling him, the boss had said, you got to hurry. And so he said, don't be telling me to hurry. I said, look, I just need you to stay focused and do the job. And he said, don't threaten me. You know, you ever seen a discussion go from nothing to escalation? And I said, I'm not threatening you. I'm just telling you what the guy said to do. And he said, if you say any more to me, I'm going to hit you. I said, I don't fight. I'm a Christian. He said, oh, really? Now, I want to warn you, if you tell people stuff, they might pay attention to it. And he said, let me see you turn the other cheek. Pow, he hit me. So I said, okay. And he hit me again. Now, that second time surprised me. Okay? I had faith it was going to be one shot. But he took 4 or 5. And it dawned on me, this is not turning out the way I thought. So I pushed him off, and I had skin moved, and I had teeth that were not the same shape as they were before, and I felt humiliated because it was in a public place. But you know, I never really got over that. I was angry. I didn't do anything. We didn't terminate the guy or anything like that. I did what I thought was right. My outsides were one thing. My insides were another. I really hated that guy. I just couldn't get over it. One day I stood in the pulpit and I looked out and I said, you know, I stand here and I talk to you about how to live your life and what it means, and I don't even know if I'm going to make it. I just don't know if I'm going to make it myself. And I resigned. I said, I think you need somebody else where their insides match their outsides. And I was married to a woman, and I was a terrible husband, by the way. You think I was bad in the haymow. I was terrible in the... I'm kind of ashamed to even say this. But when I was going through my 12 steps and I was looking at my amends, my first wife, name is on my amends list, and I can't remember hardly anything about her. It's just like very few memories. I had a wrong attitude. She was like a possession. She was like a pet. But we got married because that's what you're supposed to do, you know. If you're in that church, you marry somebody in the church, and you only got a selection. It was eeny, me, you. I'm going with you. Do you want to get married? Yes. No. How about you then? It was just the way we did it. It wasn't arranged. It was just a countdown. So between being a terrible husband that had no love for the person I was married to being a pastor that didn't have something on the inside that matched the outside. And my brother asked me years later, my two brothers are still pastors and ministers. I mean, it was like a family thing. And they asked me, why did you leave? I said, because I never changed on the inside. Something is wrong with me on the inside. And they said, well, if you don't have what we're talking about, we don't blame you. And I was okay with that, because the closest I came to being real was when I faced up to the fact I had to change or I was getting out. So I got out. The story gets better, so don't get too sad yet. Once I quit, I had 10 years in which I decided I was just going to go crazy. I had 10 years of a debauched lifestyle. By the way, I pretty much had a guide. If it said, thou shalt not, I pretty much had my checklist. I was just going to go down the line and try whatever it was I had always thought I wanted to try but didn't get a chance. And during that 10 years, I gave up all contact with my family. I did not talk to my dad, my mom, my brothers, or any of them for 5 solid years. Not one phone call, not one letter, not one moment of reaching out. And talking about Al-Anon, my dad being a natural Al-Anon guy, I showed up 5 years later, knocked on his door. He opened it up and he looked at me and said, well, hi, Lou. How good to see you. And he invited me in his house, and it was like we never talked about what happened unless I wanted to talk about what happened. It was just amazing to me that he was willing to just not sit there and dig into the past. He was interested in where are we now and what are we going to do. I also discovered during that period of time, you know, I never thought I had alcoholics in my life. Until I got into Al-Anon, I didn't even realize I'd been raised in an alcoholic family. My earliest memory of my granddad was when I was probably 6 years old, and he had me on one knee, he had my brother on the other knee, and a can of beer. I'd get a sip, grandpa'd get a sip, my brother'd get a sip. Grandpa'd get a sip, I'd get a sip, and he passed it back and forth. That's about the only memory I have of my grandfather. And I thought, well, maybe there is one alcoholic. And then there's my two half-brothers. And my half sister, she's an alcoholic too, and I guess really you got to count my Uncle Booty, and then there's my Uncle Bud, and I got to remember, and my list just gets, how blind can I be to where my broken thinking came from? A family that, and my mother didn't know any more than what they taught her, and she passed it down to me, and it's just a generational piece of experience and training. And during that 10 years, I was pretty angry with God. I was desperate for there not to be a God, because I knew that I was not in a position to meet God. I just felt, you know, that from all the training I'd had in this religious group. Then I had a job at a company up in Chattanooga, and this woman walked in. And I don't know what it was about her, but it clicked. She looked good. She interviewed well. And she was, the only drawback she had, she was married. So for 5 to 6 years, I just watched her from afar. I ended up in California because the company I was with had bought a part of a larger organization, and I was out there helping carve it out. Turns out she had gotten a divorce, and somebody told me about it. Man, I came back to Chattanooga, we dated, and we got married. And I told my, that, and she's my wife today, and I told her, I said, you know, there's something about you that just fits. I don't know what it is. You just fit me, everything about you. And it wasn't just the fact that she looked good. I mean, that helped. But there was something else about her. Now, you would think I would have picked up on some hints. I flew into Chattanooga one time. It was winter. It was cold. It was rainy. And I get off the plane from California because she and I are now dating, and she's standing there in the airport like this. And from the end of the concourse, you can see she's twitching. And it turns out she was wet from here down, literally soaking wet, dripping on the concourse. I said, what happened? She says, my car, I ran into a puddle and it died. A puddle? We ought to go see this. So we go over to the puddle, and her headlights are under the water. And she said, well, when I opened the door, you know, I just waited on a cross. That's what normal people would do, right? I thought, it turns out she had had some little wine, and she was laying on the couch, and she had fallen asleep, and it was the last minute, and she was dashing in the car to pick me up at the airport. She went in the back way that had police barricades around it saying, do not enter, and she just went right through them. You'd think I would have had a hint. Well, we got married. I was living in California at the time. We got married, and we just everything about our life was about drinking. Everything was about. I was again just not even aware of how broken my thinking was. I'd get up on Sunday mornings and I would go downstairs and I'd get wine and pour it in a glass while she was in bed and resting, and I'd put it in the microwave and warm it up because it was kind of nice to have warm wine first thing on a Sunday morning. Does that sound like somebody that doesn't get it? Sometimes she couldn't drive because she maybe had one drink too many. One time I was in Chicago, and she was back in Los Angeles, and I got a phone call, and she said, you know, I'm laying in the floor, and I'm too weak to get up. I've drank too much, and I've been down here for a long time. You'd think I'd get this, right? I walk out of a business meeting, jump on a plane, fly to L.A., drive to the house. I find her where she's at. We get her cleaned up. We get her where she can eat again. And I thought, I fixed it. Well, it's not really the way it turns out. And by the way, you think I was crazy in Hay Mall and crazy in the church? You should have seen me in that marriage. I'll give you an example. We were playing golf. How safe can you be? Golf. And we were at this resort, and she was over on the passenger side of the car, and I was driving, and I pulled in at the turn so we could go in and get something to drink, a beer or something. And as I started to back the car up, it hit something. And so I rolled forward and gave it a good run at it, you know. And it took me about 3 shots to get over whatever that was. It turned out it was my wife. There were people there that were aghast. And they ran over and got her and drug her out from under the car. And she had tread marks on her. They packed her with ice, and I felt bad. Well, the next day, she's recuperated enough that she's out trying to play, and they had concrete cart paths. And we had metal cleats on our shoes back then. And she was down about 20, 30 yards in front of me, and she slipped. And she fell right on the cart path really hard. So I jumped in the cart and was racing down the path, and the people on the course started screaming, stop him, stop him, he's trying to kill her. Believe it or not, we didn't think anything about it. That's just something that happened. I'm a broken thinker. There came a day where my wife finally got to the point where she just couldn't function, wasn't able to go to work. She was desperately in need of help, and we checked her into a treatment center. And that began my introduction into Al-Anon. That was the precipitating event that got me involved in this. We went to a psychologist for a while. Over in Beverly Hills. My theory was if you paid more, you'd get well faster. After 4 or 5 months, whatever it was, he looked at her and said, you go to AA, and said, you're sick too, buddy. You go to Al-Anon. We went to Al-Anon, but I was a good Al-Anoner right from the get-go because I went to every AA meeting that she went to and sat right there to make sure everything was fine. I was a help. And I would cover for her. Now, let me tell you why I think that matters in my story. I did not know it, but I was practicing the art of brinkmanship. It's kind of like if I was on the Grand Canyon wall, up on the plateau, and my alcoholic would want to run toward that cliff, and I would get between her and the cliff. And then sometimes she'd get right to the edge, but I would save her yet again. And she learned that I would always be there to save her, therefore she didn't have to worry about it. She would let me deal with it, and I was happy to deal with it because I had built a familiar family, just like I came out of, where we keep our secrets, we take care of one another, it doesn't matter what you do. Besides, I needed you to be broken so I could look good and feel that I had a role. It's the way it was for me. But it just turns out that she got where she would leap over the edge of the Grand Canyon in desperate health issues. And then she got where, and I realized one day that I actually was part of the problem. I kept going to Al-Anon, and I finally began to realize I had taught her that she could run as fast as she could go, leap as far as she could leap, and that I would be there to pull her back up by the fingernails to get her back onto the top. And the fact was, she was going to leap one time, and I was not going to be able to do it, and it scared me to realize I had taught her a dangerous way of living. I had contributed to the problem. Well, we had moved back to Chattanooga, Tennessee, and she had a relapse. By the way, she went 5 years after that treatment center, and she didn't drink. And one day in her job, she has to serve alcohol to some of the clients that she worked with in her sales job, and she had some bottles of vodka and different kind of liquor. And she hadn't served any of it in several months. It had been up upstairs, and she thought, well, if I'm going to serve it, I need to make sure the alcohol is still in it. So she sampled each one. She was off again. This time, it was low as she could go. She'd lay in bed and pass out, lay in bed, pass out, lay in bed, couldn't go to work. And Al-Anon taught me that I was part of the problem, and that meant I had to apply the tools of Al-Anon for me to bring any value to this relationship. So I was scared to death, but I said to my wife, I said, I don't know how to do what I'm about to do. I don't know how to do it well. But I'm going to do what I think is called detachment. I am out of your disease. I'm not going to do anything that will aid alcoholic behavior. And I said, if you want to go for treatment, you have to ask. I'm not going to encourage you. If you want any help, you've got to guide me through it. And I don't think she believed me. Some time passed, and one day she came to the room, to the door room, to the bedroom upstairs, and she said, I need someone to take me to a treatment center. Would you take me? I said, if you want to go, yes. We got in the car. I said, where do you want to go? She said, anywhere you pick. I said, I'm not picking. I have nothing to do with this recovery. Every step from here on is yours. I had already got to the point where she was just right at the edge of destruction, and I had aided and abetted. She said, all right, take me to this particular treatment center. I've been to these others, and they didn't do any good. I said, okay. I got her there. I said, we're here. She said, I'm too weak to walk in. Would you take me in? I said, no. She said, well, I can't walk in. I said, then I guess I'd take you home. She said, well, would you go get a nurse to take me in? I said, I'll do that. The nurse came out, helped her in. They were willing to fill out the paper. I said, would you help fill out the paper? I said, no. It's her recovery. Now, I got to tell you, I detached with an axe. I did not detach with love. I did not. I didn't know what else to do except just take the tool in blind faith and just live it the way I thought they told me about it. And the only contribution I ever made to her recovery was when I got out of it. Every other contribution aided and abetted a disease that was about to kill the person that I wanted in my life. So she checked herself in, and I looked over at the person that checked her in, and that person looked at me, and by then had figured out I was not being very helpful. And that woman said, she's ours now. We're just giving you instructions. You drive her down to Birmingham. You take her to this address. You take her tonight. You don't go home. You have nothing to say about this, but get her there and let them take her in. Then you leave and don't come back until we invite you. And that's pretty much the way it happened. That was the last time she went into a treatment center. She's 8 years sober, and she's done it on her own. She owns her own sobriety. I thank Al-Anon not only for helping me, but for helping me get out of destroying another person. That's a big deal to me, and it would never have happened in our family. We stick with you until we bury you. I'm not exaggerating. I remember going into an uncle's room. He's laying in the floor, the bottles around him, the bottles that were bought so he wouldn't have to drive drunk. And he's dead. I can remember my uncle over Booty. It's a different one. I remember him. By the way, in our family, everybody had real names and everybody had not real names. Whatever name is on your birth certificate, they picked one they didn't want to use. His name was Marion. They called him Booty. I had a cousin with a perfectly good name. Her name was Mary. They called her Bootsy. I had an aunt whose name was Willie, and they called her Bill. The thing that I want to point out is that Al-Anon helped me get around all the craziness that I had grown up with and that I had come to believe. And I was out of the church. I didn't have a God. I had a wife that was struggling. And in Al-Anon, I decided I was going to give it a shot. By the way, when I first got in Al-Anon in L.A., I was going to 4 and 5 meetings a day, because my job allowed me to do what I wanted. And I found a lot of comfort in going to those meetings, but I didn't find recovery until I started getting some help. And there's a big difference, but I needed both. So one of the things they told me in Al-Anon was there are no musts. I liked that, because I'd been told what I had to do all my life. Family raised me that way. The church told me that was the way it was. And in Al-Anon, you don't have to do anything if you don't want to do it. So I kept going because I kind of liked that. And I began to stumble. I didn't walk in and embrace Al-Anon. I wasn't your best Al-Anoner. I was more of an Al-Anon ick. You know, I would show up, but I just wasn't the best Al-Anon anything. One day I was in a meeting in Chattanooga, because we'd moved back to Chattanooga by then, and I finally opened up about my mother. It turns out that I really was angry at my mother all of my life. I hated my mother. My mother was a monster in my mind. I told people, I said, the world will be a better place if my mother's dead. It's pretty harsh. And my mother had died 5, 6, 7 years. And I opened up in an Al-Anon meeting and I said, this is what happened and this is what went on. And I just was blunt and I told it. And they looked at me and they said, let's get this straight. You hate your mother. She's been dead for 6, 7, 8 years. Whatever the word, I don't remember how many it was then. It was quite a while. And you still resent her? And you're still angry at her? And she's gone? I said, yes. I said, you made a god out of that woman. She controls you from the grave. And that actually registered in my mind, and I realized that, oh my goodness, I was in a daze. Because, I mean, I went to her funeral to kick dirt on the casket. I showed up at the funeral. As I stepped out of that Al-Anon room at the East Brainerd Club in Chattanooga, Tennessee, in a daze, I just said, Mom, I will let you go if you will let me go. And it was like somebody took a big old wet coat and just pulled it off my shoulders. It was different. And I realized that that resentment had been eating me up since I was 8 years old, when some stuff happened that just happened. And I had just fought and spit and hated and just been filled with anger all those years, and it was just gone. It was an unbelievable experience. Another thing that happened to me was a little bit about the God thing. I'd sit in Al-Anon meetings. By the way, I went to a lot of open AA meetings. AA members, I thank you for letting people like me in your meetings. We didn't have a lot of Al-Anon meetings, and it was great that you would let me in, because it was a place to hide. And I heard some stuff that kind of registered. Thank you, thank you, thank you. And one of the things that I kept dealing with was God. Here's what I would share in the AA and Al-Anon meetings. I don't believe there's a God, and if there is a God, and I could find him, one of us would have to die. I'm not sure that God quaked in heaven, but that was my attitude, and this was not a one-week deal. I was like this for a number of years, and I really, and it didn't seem to faze those AA people. They're tougher than shoe leather. It didn't faze those Al-Anon people. They absolutely had something going on that said, okay, we accept you the way you are. Keep coming back. By the way, when I first went there, I went there to get somebody else fixed, and I needed some help, and they just said, blah, 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 keep coming back. I went to the next meeting, blah, 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 keep coming back. I don't know what that blah, 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 blah was. And then one day, blah, 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 started turning into words that made sense to me. Thank you for not giving up on me. Thank you for saying the same words over and over for 4 years. It finally helped and made a difference in my life. When it comes to the God thing, I had a list of all the things in my head that I believed I'd learned about God. And then I had a list that I began writing down during meetings about what people would say about the higher power that they were describing in these recovery meetings. And the longer I looked at those two, the more I kept finding things came off my list about what people really said about God. All I heard about God was available. All I heard about God was would help you in recovery. All I heard about God was as you understand him. All I heard was, and you don't have to, but when it happens to you, you'll like it. I didn't hear all that other stuff that was in my past. And I finally got to the point where I said, you know, maybe I'm wrong. Seems like the people that are in recovery have some ideas that work. And I said, okay, I kind of accept that. So what should I do? They said, you might want to try going to, you might want to pray. Oh, I've done so much praying. In fact, in seminary, I wasn't a good student. We have what we used to call foot washing in seminary. You go in and you wrap a towel around your waist and you take off your shoes and you wash this other guy's foot. Well, I was in seminary and I didn't enjoy this, so I got this guy. I happen to know he was ticklish. So, man, I got a hold of that, and he's a big guy, and I ran my finger between his toes. And I got in trouble in seminary. But they said, you might want to try prayer. So I did. The very first time that I was willing to pray, I remember they had circled up, and I had circled with them, and a woman looked over at me and said, Lou, would you take us out with the Lord's Prayer? And I went, I can't. I don't pray. She said, that's okay. We're glad you're here. And she led the Lord's Prayer. And I knew right then somebody had offered me a chance to be a part of. I had turned it down, and I would never do that again, even if I didn't believe it. So I started saying the prayer, just doing the function. Next thing they said is, maybe you want to go to Sunday night and do this meditation meeting for an hour. And I said, well, do I have to believe it? No, you don't have to believe anything. You don't even have to go. All right, I'll go then. Since I don't have to, I'm going to go. I went in, we practiced meditation for 2 years every Sunday night. I went in and I practiced meditation, and they'd say, get real still. Try to just blank your mind. See what thoughts come. Write them down. Get groceries in the morning. Tell your wife she should not get that low on the gas. But you know, over time, my list started changing because I started noticing I was writing things about, maybe it was about attitude, it was about behavior. And I went and I kept doing this. And what I have found out is in Al-Anon is that Al-Anon is kind of like walking. If I want to lose weight and I can walk, if I just do the action, I don't have to believe I'm going to lose weight. But if I get out and walk 3 blocks and I come home, and I did, and I got on the scale, nothing changed. It wasn't working. So I did 4 blocks. Came back home, jumped on the scale. Nothing changed. I was proving walking doesn't work. I was up to about a mile, and I came in one morning, and I got on the scales. It was 2 pounds lighter. Maybe it worked. Maybe I didn't eat right. But I kept adding a few steps to my walking, another half a block every time I went. Next thing, I was down 5 pounds. I was down 8 pounds. I was down 12 pounds. I was down from 210 down to about 175. And if I just take the actions that I am learning about in here, they work in my life, and I get results whether I believe it or not. And something in me began to change. I began to want this. I will say this about guidance. I'm going to tell you more than I know, okay? And I'm making some of this up. But guidance for me reminds me of the time I was riding down the road in my car, and I thought I heard something in the engine. I turned off the radio, and I was listening. And I slowed down so there wouldn't be so much noise from the tires, and I was listening. And I kept listening, and finally there it was again, a little kind of like a tap, 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 tap. And if I listened just right, I could get it from time to time. And that's the way guidance was for me. I found that I kind of had these thoughts that kind of, they were my thoughts. Every one of them were my thoughts, but some of them seemed a little bit influenced. And I kept going to that 11-step meeting, and I kept getting more of these thoughts that seemed to be influenced. The next thing you know, most of what I wrote down was about how I should behave today and what my attitude should be today. And I said, well, I'm just going to do it. I walked. I just did what was, you know, not all of my thoughts were inspired, but none of them hurt me. And the ones that I took, it was amazing at how my life changed. My alcoholics are not even part of my story anymore. By the way, talking about qualifiers, you know who my qualifier is today? Me. I'm sick. I was raised and taught the wrong rules of life. I need a different set of rules. I am my own qualifier today. I am a broken thinker. I'm not just a guy on twine. I'm broken. I'm not just a guy that runs over his wife in a golf cart. I'm more than just that. I'm a broken thinker. And I'm here to tell you today that when I get these little tap, 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 taps now and I use them, it's a way for me to survive and live. I'll tell you something else about my sense of guidance. My metaphor for guidance is this, is it's like I'm out in the woods and the woods are on fire and I've got this walkie-talkie. And way up on a hill, way, 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 way over there is a Smokey Bear kind of ranger up in a tall fire building. He's looking down, and he can see the whole lay of the land. And I say, help, help, can you help us? I'm over here with some people, and the woods are on fire. And my walkie-talkie crackles and goes, you better go to the left and rock. Could you make that more clear, maybe? Left, rock. Hey, guys, I think I got to go to the left, and I think it's a rock over there. Are you sure? No. I go over there. All right, I'm over here, left rock, and go up the bank, and don't worry, fire. Write it down, I do. Did you know it's a funny thing? That even though it's all garbled sometimes, and sometimes it's more clear than others, when I take my chances on that kind of stuff, I am so far ahead of the game, it is unbelievable. I don't have a channel that's clear like some people talk about it. Mine is like a walkie-talkie with a loose speaker. I think that that's as best, as better than I ever had before. So I was getting this sense of guidance before I ever had my awakening, or I was having a gradual awakening as I get, but I hadn't hit a moment of absolute awareness. Then one day I had gotten to the point that I was just whipped. I literally can tell you that I could realize that I was miserable. I didn't know how to live my life. The alcoholic was sober. I still wasn't, and I wasn't the best husband in the second marriage, by the way. You know, I made mistakes in the second marriage. Oh, you won't believe. I decided to work the 12 steps by myself. I'd heard you talk about them. I'm smart. I'm a clever guy. So I did the 12 steps. Took me about 30 minutes, and I commented and shared about it, and they said maybe you should get some help, and I did. So I found an AA that's, you know, we practice the steps of AA ourselves. That's in our traditions. So I found an alcoholic that would take me through. Met every Saturday with him at Cracker Barrel, and I would whine and moan and groan and. I became known as the whiner with the wino. You know, but they put up with it and they kept taking me through the steps. And as I went through them, I began to learn how they really ought to work. And the thing that really motivated me to get that sponsor so I could do them better was when I did it by myself, I decided that I should do step 5 with my wife. It gets better. We were going to take a weekend trip from Chattanooga to Johnson City, if you know where that is. It's 3 hours up, 3 hours back. A perfect time to do a step five. We were going to be together for 6 solid hours, and we can't get out of the car. Perfect for a broken thinker. If you hang around in a hay mall with me, we're going out the door. I'm a broken thinker. On my own, I come up with things. I need guidance from people, and I need guidance from a program, and I need guidance from a God. So I shared with her everything. Everything. I wasn't faithful in my marriage. I shared with her everything. It didn't work out real well. I came back to Chattanooga after a very long 6 hours. And I was talking about it with the folks there, and they said, "Lou, absolute honesty without wisdom is brutality. You don't ever do that again. You get you a sponsor." I got me an AA sponsor, and I went through and I started working the steps with adult supervision. I'm a broken thinker, and you continue to help me and work with me. When it comes down to this working the steps, there came a day when I'd been working the steps, and I was just whipped. I was broken. I could see that my life was going to continue to be riddled with broken thinking, that I just had something wrong with me. And even though my life was getting better in many ways, I wasn't changing on the inside. And I just wasn't able to go any further. I couldn't live the life I wanted. And I just was whipped. I don't know how to tell you. I don't know what to call that, except there was just no lower to go. I was just whipped. And I said, "God, I'm not asking you to fix it. I'm not asking you to change it. I'm just asking you to help me go through it. I'm whipped. I'm not here to control. I'm not here to barter. Just go help me go through it so I'm not alone. I don't think I can do this alone." And somehow, something clicked for me, and I've never quite been the same. My insides began to match my outsides. And the steps made that possible, because I had been going through the steps over and over and over with people, and I had come to believe that the first 10 steps never added a thing to my life. The first 10 steps took stuff out of my life that was blocking me from having any chance to believe a higher power would have anything to do with me. And when I was desperate and I was at the bottom and I had been cleaning myself up and I finally got to that point, it was just there. It was for me. And I don't know how to explain this, but it was that was when the sense of guidance began to not just be something I noticed, but it began to be real to me. And the best I can explain to you, it's like this. It's like being out on a really dark night in a really big field. And down at the far end, suddenly there's this little flicker of a light. And I can see that light because it's so dark. And that light, as it moves, I can see it and I can follow it. And if I follow that, it takes me in paths that work for me. I don't know anything more about the light except to just do my best to stay with it. Sometimes it goes behind trees, but it pops out the other side. Sometimes it seems to be just over the hill, but I keep walking to where it was, and there it is again. And it has become real to me. It has become soft, gentle, but real, and I use it. And I make my notes, and I still follow it. By the way, I now look back differently on religion. I believe that they may have had something going on that was real for them, too. The difference was, I couldn't differentiate between the light of life, that little flicker, and the big trucks that were pulling up and flashing their headlights in my eyeballs. I got caught up in the pomp and the rules and the whatever we want to call that. And being a clever, broken thinker like I was, I thought, well, if I can't see that light, but these other big lights are here, I think I'll just get closer to the big light. So I put my eye right on that headlight. That's going to help. Other people said, "Hey, These lights don't help us. Let's go around to the back of that tractor trailer with the big lights and see where that little light that really makes a difference is at. So I think I'm one of the luckiest guys I know. I used to go to meetings and say, I am the luckiest man in the world. The AA crowd shut me down. They said they will provide plenty of competition. So I tell you today, I'm about as lucky as a guy like me can possibly get. And if it gets any better, I'll take it. I was in Nevada about 2 weeks ago working on a project out there on the job that I work on. And we were sitting at a business meeting, and about 8 months ago, somebody up there had fired my staff on the last 2 weeks of a big, long project and left me hanging. And I was bitter about that. I was angry, kind of like with my mother. I was resenting. And in this business meeting, these people that had made that decision, their name came up, and I could see myself fighting against them, and I could see myself just not able to stop my resentment. And I went home and I went to bed that night in the hotel, and I dreamed that night. And in the dream, I was outside my house and down at the bottom of the driveway, and I had a bunch of furniture and stuff piled up. And my neighbor came over, and we were having a conversation, and we became angry with each other. And my neighbor left, and I had lost a neighbor. The dream, I got up, I woke up or something, I went back and slept and did some more dreaming. And by the way, I don't believe dreams always come with mystery. When I was a kid on a bicycle, I saw a cigar on the side of the road one day. I went home and I was dreaming about a cigar that night. I could make the connection. It was no magic, okay? But sometimes I've got stuff going on in my head, and I dream about the stuff that's going on in my head, and I see it more clearly through a dream sometimes than I would otherwise. I'm not mystical about this. And I knew when I was having those dreams, it was about that conversation I'd had in that business meeting that afternoon. And I went, and in the dream, there was another person up the street somewhere else, and we had a big discussion, and the next thing I know, there was talk about guns and violence. And I woke up, and after two or three dreams like this, I said, you know, resentment just kills. It just destroys. And I went back to the next day in the meeting. I said, you know, we were talking about this in the business meeting. I was just wrong. I'm just wrong. They did what they had to do, and we made it just fine, and I don't need that. I can support whatever you guys want to do as a business. And so for me, it was important because I'm sitting here thinking, I'm one of the luckiest people in the world, and I'm over here hating these two people in New York. Luckiest guy in the world. One of the luckiest guys in the world. As lucky as I can be, and I'm hating you. There's something wrong with that picture. There's something wrong with that. I want this picture. This can just go away. And just like with Mom, it was nice to feel it just slip away. I don't know how to let it go until I can let it go, but every time I let it go, I win. That's just the way it has been for me. I got to stop. I'm so grateful that there are no musts in Al-Anon because it allowed me to never be driven away. And every place in the past, it always had musts. I stumbled into it, I stayed in it, and it has been the most wonderful thing in life. I close by saying this. These are some notes that I want to just read because they came from my meditation and they're part of me. I can't care, I now know, I can't care enough to change the insides of another person. I tried that for years. If I could change you, I'd be happy. I just had to face it. There is the relationship I had in my mind, and there is the relationship that I can have. Choose. I have a concept of what a relationship with a higher power seems to be like. There seems to be something bigger going on, perhaps a purpose, and I don't get to know what that purpose is all about, but I get to be part of it. I never really enjoyed my recovery until I gave up all hope of ever having the childhood I always wanted. I'm learning to take care of myself by using a new set of rules. I'm learning that my stories are just stories. The facts are the same, but the stories are different. I'm no longer a victim. Today, I have found something that lets me be free. That's huge for me. And my awakening as a result of the 12 steps is kind of like if you go down the road here to Main Street, there's a signal light and an intersection. If I go hang around in that intersection long enough, what's going to happen to me? I'm going to get hit. And for me, the 12 steps were just like being in an intersection. I kept doing the 12 steps, and I didn't change. I did the 12 steps again, I didn't change. I did them poorly, I didn't change. I did them more thorough, I didn't change. One day, I changed. And it was magic. It's just magic. I couldn't have planned it. In fact, I kept doing the steps after that. And I was on a pink cloud. You ever heard of those? And I was complaining. I said, I've been on a pink cloud now for almost 12 months. I said, I'm not sure if this is real. They said, well, what are you doing? What are you doing? I said, I keep doing the steps. I said, oh, just quit doing the steps. Did I tell you I was a broken thinker? I quit doing the steps. It went away. I called my sponsor a few days ago and I said, hey, Barbara, I'd like to do the steps again. I'm ready to talk. Let's get together again. I miss that sense of, wow, everything is good no matter what everything is. And then I close with this last sentence. I kept using my way of thinking, hoping for different results, but I always ended up where my thinking always took me. Then I decided to use the thinking used by people who recovered. I did. I recovered. I ended up with results like theirs, and I ran into a higher power. I came to Al-Anon because I needed to. I stayed because I want to. My name is Lou, and I am grateful to be a member of a 12-step recovery program. Thanks. Thank you.